Hey, and welcome to the Happy Rant Podcast. I am your ersatz host, Barnabas Piper. Ted Cluck is absent today, and so Ronnie and I are taking this one ourselves. Hopefully, we can make our way through this without our professional host. I feel a little bit inadequate when I compare myself to Ted in the hosting seat. It's a little too big for me.
You should, because it's almost like when one of us has to do a promo, we feel inadequate because you own the promos. But what does ersatz mean again?
I think it's like a sorry substitute with crappy ingredients.
How do you spell that? I can't even
visualize. It's a German word, so I'm assuming there's lots of T's and Z's. I think it's ersatz, maybe?
Oh, yeah.
It's one of those words that I have...
ersatz?
I've read it and I've heard it in audiobooks.
So we don't even know if it's the right, like, well, how you said it. We have no clue if that was.
Well, it's
right.
German, so I'm sure I'm supposed to like hock a loogie while I'm saying it too, but I don't know.
I mean, how do you know that was even the right like definition of it in the way that you used it?
I looked it up one time because I heard it.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, it was, and it was people. The reason I assume that's the definition, I didn't look it up, but in context, it was people making coffee or tea out of like acorns and pine needles, and they called it like ersatz coffee. And I'm like, oh
man.
So it's like a crappy substitute using the wrong ingredients, which sounds a lot like me hosting this podcast.
And it kind of sounds like what I just liked. I just liked what you said though about the pine cones and the acorns and stuff.
You're like, that sounds Christmassy.
It sounds very fall. I mean, it's September 2nd, which is like, is the kickoff for fall for me. So I'm all about it. I'm all up in that right now. So yeah.
Oh, but to save you from having to do a promo, I'll bear that burden today as well, because we do have a sponsor for this episode.
Let's get into your space right now, Pi.
All right. Yes. Now I'm back in my seat where I feel comfortable. It's broken in. It's warmed up. It's good to go. We have our longtime partner, Dwell Bible App, back sponsoring the podcast again. So if you go to dwellapp.io/happyrant. So dwellapp.io/happyrant. You can find out more details there. But Dwell is an audio Bible app, multiple narrators, listening plans, a whole variety of features to help you engage scripture in different ways. They have music you can play over it if you want to kind of create a listening environment. They have read or listen and reflect types of things where you can listen to the same thing repeatedly on pause to help you memorize or study. It's a really fantastic app that I use with some regularity. My wife uses it every day, like she's getting ready for work and just has it on. That's sort of her morning routine, and it's just a great way to sort of create an environment of scripture. There is a cost attached, but if you go to that link I mentioned, dwellapp.io/happyrant, you get a 20% discount on either an annual or a lifetime subscription, and the annual one is less than $2 a month, so it's $23.99 for the year. Really not expensive, and it's a really valuable, useful resource. So go to dwellapp.io/happyrant. Check it out. Download Dwell today. It's a great way to fill up your commute, going for a run, help you with studying, memorizing, etc. So go ahead and check that out.
That was good, man. I feel like I feel like too, on top of that, besides promoting Dwell Bible app, I feel like I want to acknowledge something that just seems to pop up whenever an app lands without one of us on it, and that is that our good friend, my good friend, at Jared C. Wilson, will inevitably go on social media and just say, "Hey, can you guys either just do these things, the three of you, or just not do them at all?" That's basically, I feel like, what he's saying whenever we drop a sort of an insufficient app into his world.
Do you want to know why that doesn't matter to me? Because
yeah,
he listened.
Love to know that.
Because he
to
downloaded know. And listened before he made that comment.
He still listens.
So we win.
So he still listens.
Yeah.
Whether it's a Happy Abby rant, whether it's a sports rant, whatever he is just consistently dissatisfied with, he still listens.
You know how network TV shows, you get on CBS and they have all of these shows that are like the Chicago Fire, Chicago PD, whatever. And then they do these crossover episodes, which are never good. I mean, the whole show is not good, but the crossover episodes are always like a half step down. And so I'm sure viewers are like, man, I wish they wouldn't do that. But guess what they just did? They tuned in at 7 p.m. and watched this crappy show. So if you wish we wouldn't do something, but you're still downloading and listening,
How do we say thank you?
Yeah, I really appreciate the time you've given us, and feel free to send your comments to tcluck@uu.edu.
What I feel like it does is our less, I don't know how to phrase it, you know, our less popular singles, you know, to use like a music term, it just gives strength to our better ones, you know?
Well, see, and that's the thing is, like, you lived in the world of music that was not mainstream. And so being criticized for not being popular or mainstream enough must just completely fall on deaf ears with you.
Oh, yeah. It just doesn't make any sense to me, because it's like, I mean, at the rate that we drop these eps, it's like, hey, if you weren't real satisfied with this app, you're going to get like 40 minutes into it and another one's probably going to drop anyway. So like, just wait a minute. Like,
yeah, or we'll take 3 weeks off because I forget to post something. Like, that's how this works.
Post something from 4 years ago that you've forgotten about or never heard anyway, and it'll be like a new app. So it doesn't matter.
Have we ever made a promise to the listeners other than like sheet cake at the live event? Because I feel like we don't have anything to hold ourselves to, so we can do whatever we want.
Oh, absolutely. There's no promises here. I mean, we're not God. This is not holy scripture. We're not
covenanting with listeners to provide anything.
We're not covenanting with anybody, right? We covenant with really our wives. Like, that's it, right? And then we record this app. We record these apps every week, and either you get it or you don't, or you get a version of it that you don't like as much as the quote unquote real version of it, which, because we've made no promises, there is no like real or unreal version of it. It just is what it is.
Yeah. And I think, I feel like we don't even commit to give like effort on this. We don't commit to anything other than we'll do this when we feel like it.
Some of us don't even commit to recording. Like this week, Ted.
Ted did not. There was no breach of contract when he tapped out on this one.
There was no breach of contract. I missed 2 weeks, and you just got a little ornery about it, like you typically do about everything. And like, we just carried on. You know,
ornery is like my default response to anything that inconveniences me slightly. So that wasn't remotely personal. It's just,
of course,
you know,
I feel that way. I'd be like, okay.
That the response that I gave you about that is the same way that I feel like if somebody pauses for 3 seconds after the light turns green, there's just a general orneriness. Like, come on, you can do better than this.
You can do better. And then 1 second later, you don't even remember you were ornery.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Because you're ornery about something else.
Just move on. It's, you know, it's not a, this is not a deep rooted bitterness thing.
Pipe, here's what I want to know, man. So why is the pod better with the three of us? Why can we never get like a two for a combo with the pod where everybody's like, dude, that's the best one I ever heard. I wish the other guy would just sit out like forever. Why is that?
I have a couple of thoughts on this. One is, and I'm going to butcher, it's not an actual quote, but it's a comment that C.S. Lewis made.
Whoa, you just pulled that one out of your hat, man.
No, well, I heard it recently from somebody on staff at our church, and we were talking about people moving on from the church and kind of the effect that it has, like somebody moved out of state, you know, somebody who was a leader and really great, whatever. And C.S. Lewis said something, I think it was when Owen Barfield passed. So, you know, they had this group of friends.
Yeah.
And he said that when Owen Barfield passed, it changed the nature of his relationship with Tolkien. So that third person added something to the relationship between the two of them.
Yes.
So the whole dynamic. So it wasn't just like 3 minus 1 is 2.
Yes.
It was like 3 minus 1 is orange. And so it shifted the whole kind of reality of things. The other one is just sort of the analogy of the three-legged stool. Like, when all three of us are here, like, we can be crooked, but we can't be wobbly. Like, it's kind of always solid. And when it's two of us, we have to kind of balance it just right.
Interesting. I'll go with both of those. And
that was sort of like a verbal Yoda tweet.
The three-legged stool one. And again, if I haven't heard a C.S. Lewis quote recently, it's because I have not heard an evangelical sermon recently, of which he's
quoted. Yeah, and I managed to get Lewis and Tolkien into one story,
you
so
did.
I feel like I've made up for lost time for some of you who have haven't been able to go to church. Your white reformed pastor has not been filling your ears with quotes by Samwise Gamgee and whatever else. So
I believe you're saved now, Pipe.
Yeah.
There were doubts before, but you start quoting Lewis, and then not only that, you do a dub Lewis quote. I'm like, this is a man of God I'm talking to right now.
I felt like I leveled it out with the sort of like bottom shelf leadership analogy, the three-legged stool, because that feels like something that Andy Stanley would say. So, you know, you've we've covered all of white evangelicalism now, other than the charismatics. Praise be. So,
but you did that weird Owen Barfield thing, which is like, oh, so hold on, everybody. Pipe is a guy who's like read some like bios on the Inklings at some point. So like he knows his stuff for sure. Or you just hung out with Ray Ortland for so long, you know everything there is to know about Lewis. I don't know.
Well, the Lewis stuff actually comes from, so Wheaton College is sort of a C.S. Lewis haven. There's the Marion Wade Center where they have the wardrobe that came out of his house, and there's C.S. Lewis classes, and it's just sort of woven into a lot of the stuff there. So I took a class on C.S. Lewis. I took classes from two different professors who are experts in C.S. Lewis. So yeah, there's been a lot of that stuff just sort of massaged into my brain. And also I love C.S. Lewis. So
yeah. Well, you have to love C.S. Lewis. You can't, you know.
Yeah, I don't know if you can be saved. I still find one of my favorite Christian ironies is that C.S. Lewis is beloved by all Reformed people, and he was not fond of Calvinism in the slightest. He thought it was utter horse crap.
He couldn't be less Reformed than he was, really. I mean, when you break down like Lewis's theology, we have so many issues with it that we just tend to go, oh, you know what? Just read Narnia. He's great.
Narnia are like my least favorite of his books, but that's probably an argument for a different day. One of my favorite Reformed things, and I almost said it instinctively until I caught myself and realized, oh, I'm a parody of myself if I do this, is to say something like C.S. Lewis was more Reformed than he realized.
Oh, dude. Yeah, absolutely.
So we understand him better than he understood himself.
Right.
He may have hated Calvinism, but he was more Reformed than he realized. So we'll just smugly land on that with our conversation of C.S. Lewis. He was just a closet Calvinist. He just didn't know it.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's funny that we don't do that with anybody else, or we at least have to wait till they've been dead 50 years before we give them those passes, you know?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I feel like. And then we get very confused because then if they've been dead for like 100 years, we start to dig up all the terrible things about them. So 50 years, we adore them. 100 years, we're like, oh, didn't treat women very well. Ugh, yeah. Racist. So, you know, with Lewis, it was like, ooh, he's been dead long enough that now we wonder about his relationship with whatever that woman's name was, Joy Davidman. I can't remember if that was the right one.
But his wife, yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, enough about C.S. Lewis. Well, you know. So Ted's absence was a late announcement. So we lost all of our show prep.
Yeah, it was. Tell everybody, like, don't give everybody the details, but like we had a particular topic in mind, and then it was like the rug got pulled.
Yeah. So we, you know, things have been crazy. Evangelical leaders have been getting fired or, you know, forced resignations and announcing that pandemics don't exist. And then famous authors of leadership books are tweeting asinine things. And we were just going to go like, so terrible it's good, and just kind of go with this stuff. But we really need Ted for that, because sometimes he has takes and sometimes he doesn't care so much that it's funny. I think we're just, sure, we have to shelve that and just see what crazy happens between now and the next time we record with him. So I had to go into my dusty archives of Happy Rant preparation and pull out some notes on some things that I've been wanting to discuss with you guys.
What's in your show vault, Pipe? I'm curious, man. I'm anxious to hear what it is.
So, yeah. So this is a list of questions about the reading life of the Happy Rant hosts.
Oh, man.
So just, okay. We are book guys, as evidenced by our lengthy discussion of the Inklings just a moment ago and our general smugness about life. So we're book guys. And so this is a conversation. This is not me interviewing you about how we arrived at being book guys and how, like, what are some of our favorites and things like that. So I'm going to throw a question on the table. Yeah. We can both answer it and then see where it takes us. This could be the suckiest episode we've done in some time, which is saying something, but here we go.
You know, yeah.
I say we try it.
Throw it out there. What do you got, Pipe?
All right. So what is the first book or a early book you remember loving? Like one of those books that you're like, man, I read that all the time as a kid, or that book made me love reading, or I remember my parents reading that to me, or my first grade teacher. What is an early book you remember loving?
Gosh, you know, it's funny because at some point, because I went to Christian school, I went to Christian elementary, middle, and high school. So at some point in, I think, my parents' like evangelical journey, you know, coming to Christ, obviously Narnia was introduced. And I remember at some, I think I was probably 8 or 9 years old when my mom started reading Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe, like did some bedtime reading for us. But before that, it was, I think it was a bunch of nondescript, just children's books, you know, those really short ones, that you, like when you're sort of that thing when you start to read at like 5 or 6 years old, and then your parents start buying you these books that you're able to read and grasp. And so it's not like those golden books where they're like 4 pages, but it's like the next 2 or 3 steps above that to okay. where you're reading about a lot of like, you know, animal creatures that are like heroes. And I remember just spending a lot of time like pouring through books of that nature. But the one that I remember the most, man, was my grandma bought me a book for my birthday. And it was one of these books that you could get custom made where you were like the guy in the book. You were the hero of the book. And so it was a book about me, and it had all of my brothers and sisters by name in the book with illustrations that remotely looked like us.
And I probably shouldn't be surprised that your favorite childhood book was about you.
It was about, yeah, I know that that doesn't say a lot of great things about me right now, but it actually like kind of, it informs people's, you know, kind of thoughts about what goes on in the psyche of Ronnie Martin. But yeah, that was the first book I read. I don't remember what it was called, but I would read to say more good things about me, Pipe. I would read that book literally constantly. I loved it. It was my story. It was my story.
All right. Follow-up question, and then I'll answer. Do you remember any childhood books or like series of books, types of books that you just hated? You're like, these are the dumbest books.
Yeah, I mean, not specifically other than I hated, I've always loved stories, so I would hate anything that started getting tedious to read that was more of like a technical nature. So if it's not, and I'm still this way in a lot of ways, if it's not intuitive and it starts getting into histories that I don't care about, it starts getting into details that seem like things that I can't relate to, my mind immediately just, it just shuts off. You know what I mean? It has to be something that I can visualize myself doing and becoming a part of. And so there was probably things that were related to school that I had to read that I would just be like, this is ridiculous. I'm never going to do this in life. I don't have any aspirations to do this in life. And I'm not I might as well just grab the book that has my name in it and that I'm the hero of. Why would I even read this? Right.
Yeah. Your aspiration was to be the hero of your life. So that's a good book to read.
We'll get a counselor in next time Ted's gone, and we can suss out some of this stuff, right?
Okay. So my answer to the first question of favorite childhood books or ones that I remember, I don't know when this book came out. So I don't know if it was like new when I was little or if it had been around a while, but it was, this will come as no surprise to listeners. Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day.
Oh yeah. I've heard of that.
I think they turned it into a movie, which doesn't make any sense because it's like an 8-page book. But it's a book about a boy who is the youngest in his family named Alexander, whose siblings ruin everything, and then he makes a mistake and his dad yells at him. And like in the end of it is just, it's been a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day, and I think I'm going to move to Australia. And like my mom gave me that book. It was sort of her version of empathy. It was here, you have 3 older brothers and your life sucks some days. Enjoy this book.
She got you, man. She was understanding your plight.
Yeah, she's like, here, this fictional character understands you. And it remains to this day. I used to read it to my kids and they got the greatest kick out of it because, you know, they don't have a bunch of older siblings. And so it was kind of a foreign world to them. But it's the kind of thing, it's very much a misery loves company book. And so it fed my childhood cantankerousness.
Pipe, let me ask you something on that, because it kind of made me think of something, because I remember reading these books, these, I think they're called the Critter books to my kid, you know, this would have been 20 years ago. Yeah. I love those books, by the way, as an adult. But what's
they sort of look like little like bug-eyed gerbil kind of creatures.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like in they were super, they were kind of funny. So they're almost more like they were like adult humor for kids in some ways. You know, they were like that. I think that's why my wife and I loved them so much. But you know what's so fascinating? I want you to riff on this for a minute. What's so fascinating about kids' books is they're all miserable stories at the end of the day. I mean, like, they're all dark, tragic. And like, let's not even get started on like Grimm's fairy tales, which are like unbelievably like dark and gory and violent. But like just regular run-of-the-mill children's books, they're dark tales. I mean, yeah. It's funny that we're dishing these things up to kids thinking, oh no, these are the happy books that they want to read, when in fact, like, they're anything but that.
Oh, and then there's the whole genre of like, hey, here's this great dog. Oh, he died. Like,
yeah, every time.
Old right. Yeller, Sounder, Where the Red Fern Grows. Then there's the Yearling, which is the same thing, but about a deer. And there's just, yeah, kids' books are full of like.
Don't even get me started on Bambi.
Well, Bambi sucks. It's just a terrible movie. But, and not because the mom dies, just because there's no characters in it who aren't annoying except Thumper.
Right.
Yeah, I don't, it is really funny. Like, but I'm trying to think of kids' books that would just be like chipper and happy. And what a boring story. Like, reading a book that's all just happiness and no conflict, no darkness, no nothing would be really lame.
Isn't it weird though that we're like, in a sense, a lot of like those critter books were like, they were kind of amazing in the fact that it was always critter trying to work himself through like a lousy situation. I mean, it was life. It was literally teaching her some aspect of life. So it's kind of funny.
Which I think is, yeah, I think that's part of why there's so much darkness. It's like people used to have a sense of like, hey kid, you better prepare because life's going to throw some fastballs right into your ribs. And so, you know, like you better get up for this. And now it's sort of like, we just want to tell every kid they're special. Like every book is about kids are special. And I'm like, they're special until like their best friend says they're not their best friend anymore. Like, how did they handle that? They don't feel special. So maybe a book should be like, hey, we need to get a book that says like, hey kid, you're not as special as you think, but you're still cool. You know,
can you imagine that? Can you imagine that children's book? Hey kid, you're not that special. Like no subtitle, just yeah. Hey kid,
grandma's lying. You're not that special.
Can you imagine, man? That should be on. That should something that should come out on Crossway, man. Hey kid, you're not that special. A reformed
That might be John MacArthur's like magnum opus at the end of his last book.
Let's not get started on Johnny Mac right now. Let's just keep that one. Let's wait till Big T returns and we can.
That's called a tease.
It was a tease. It was a big tease for Big T.
All right. Next question. Still in the youthful and childhood reading.
Hold on. What was a series of books that you hated? You
really answered the question. I hated all of the Choose Your Own Adventure books.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about those.
They were like 140 pages long, and I could never figure out how to read more than about 11 pages before I fell off a cliff or got eaten by a shark or like got beheaded by a madman. Like they just – it was always like, oh, you took a wrong turn. You're dead. And there was just no finding my way through those books in a way that was satisfying. It's like these are the laziest kind of authoring is what they are. Like I understand whoever pieced them together, I'm sure had a pretty significant job trying to put these things in order. They sucked. Those books were terrible.
Right, but I love how you're just kind of admitting like, you know, I wasn't that bright. I would get 11 pages in and I would just end up falling off the cliff every time. I could never make the right
turn.
Because it's
like, you know, you get to the place and it'd be like to go down to the basement, you know, go to page 27, to go to the attic, go to page 44, and whichever one I went to, I would die every single time. You know,
maybe just like, every page you die. Maybe that's if you would have looked through all like, the other pages, they're all death pages.
I would like to hear from a listener. Did you ever make it all the way through one of those with a happy ending? Because I think it was just you just died. Back to your point about dark children's books.
Page after like page 10.
Yeah. Boy, what a trick! And nobody's going to like sit down and do the research to figure that out.
Well, you're ripping our kids off. Tedious. Like for me, I was the kid that would have been like, I don't have time for this.
I'm gonna go ride my bike.
Yeah, I'm literally gonna go ride my BMX bike. I don't have time for this. Just get me to the end. Get me somewhere with this. You know, you're making me turn a lot of pages right now and like find numbers. I don't need to be doing that. You know.
Yeah, those were my least favorites. All right, Do you remember a book you were forced to read in school that you wish you'd read later? Like you read it in school and hated it. And this could be like all the way up to high school, maybe even college. And then if you went back later, you're like, yeah, that was actually really good. I just hated it because it was an assignment.
You know, it's so fun. Okay. So you're going to be able to speak into this one way better than me, I think, Pipe, because here's what's funny. And this is what my big M, my wife, my beloved wife, this is what she always makes fun of me about, because I went to Christian schools and Pipe, when I say Christian school, man, I'm not saying like these really developed, you know, kind of like large, really great curriculum Christian schools. I'm talking about like these churches of like 110 people that, again, this was the 70s and 80s, of course, like every church decided to start their own Christian school, and anybody that could like lead a Bible study could get a job there as a teacher. Like that was the kind of Christian schools I went to. So because of that, most of the schools I went to, they didn't have us reading books, believe it or not. So it was like, you know, every once in a while you'd get something of like a Narnia thrown in there. But for the most part, they avoided the classics because the classics were secular and you might be confronted with something that was objectionable and they didn't want to chance that. So I literally grew up not reading classics until like way later, way after. So it's just the opposite for me, which was they didn't make us read anything other than like textbooks. And my wife always just goes, it's amazing you even know how to speak right now, given your Christian background education. I don't know.
You're like, well, I did motocross and music for a long time. So being a literary whiz wasn't necessarily necessary.
It just wasn't necessary. And, you know, even though I passed all my classes, even though I ended up being valedictorian by some miraculous act of God.
In your class of four people?
My class of nine. Yes.
It's kind of the same thing.
I love it. I love how you go four and you were that close to being on target. I love how you went to the furthest exaggeration of the joke you could and you were only five off.
That was amazing. Yeah, and it's like it's in the 0 to 10 range. So yeah, I feel like I pegged that one.
But you went to – you probably – wait, you didn't – did you do homeschooling or did you go to Christian schools?
I did it all. So I went K through 3 at one Christian school, which it was slightly more developed than what you described, but still attached to a church. Then I did 4th and 5th grade at home, 6th through 9th at a different Christian school, which I would say was slightly – well, probably about the same level of development as the first one. So good education, but maybe not leaning into the literary –
sure.
Classic, yeah. So much. Like we watched the Thief in the Night movies for Bible class at that school. That tells
dude,
you something
insane.
About it.
Well, dude, it's insane because to watch Thief in the Night, I mean, Pipe, that was so after the fact for the era you were in school. I mean, it's
oh, those
it's
yeah, those crazy. Are hardcore like 70s movies. I was watching those in middle school, which was mid 90s. So we were a good 20 years late.
You're
then.
Way past it. I mean, that's like me being in like a science class in the 80s and them showing us like Plan 9 from Outer Space to get us into like science fiction movies. That it's literally insane that they would have done that.
So yeah, Christian school education, bit hit or miss for me. Then 10th grade at home, because I was in kind of lockdown negotiations with my parents because I wanted to leave that school. I hated it so much, and wanted to go to the public high school. My parents did not want me to go. And so we compromised and I homeschooled, which basically meant I did history and I did English and I cheated on math for a year. I just got all the answers out of the back of the book because nobody could teach me.
Pipe, hold on then, before you go on. Let me just add this. The thought of you going to a public high school for John and Noel Piper, I mean, it was like you were saying, hey, can you book me a flight and let me just live in Las Vegas for the next year? I mean, that was literally the equivalent of like what you were asking them when you said, can I go to public school?
Well, not to mention one of my older brothers had gone to another city, a local city high school, and had not had a very good experience. Like he had a lot of fun, but not a very good educational
experience.
That was
the problem is he had a lot of fun. Yeah.
Yeah. And I wasn't a lot like him. but there was some similarities in that my excitement was much more about playing sports than it was going to class. But anyway, 11th and 12th was at the public school, public high school, graduated from there. Yeah.
Okay. So you did end up, you ended up the wish dream, you ended up attaining it in 11th and 12th.
Yeah. I played the long game. And if you homeschool as a 15-year-old, you can make your parents' lives such that they would think it's much better to just hand you over to pagans to educate you.
Well, and Pipin, you were number four. So at that point, it's like the typical, it's the old story of the parents not caring nearly as much as they did with like one and two. They're just so tired. Well,
and we had adopted my little sister at that point. So yes. I'm 15 and we have a toddler at home. And so like my parents are like,
you do whatever you want, buddy.
Just leave. Just go. Get out of here.
Just leave us alone. That's all we're asking.
Yeah.
Leave us alone.
You know, I was able to play the, but there's two or three other kids from church who go to this school. Like there's some of these, and they were like good friends of mine too. So it was easy to kind of finagle them into that. So I had a varied educational experience. The book that I was assigned that I hated actually came during that 10th grade homeschool year because we did like this English class co-op mm-hmm. kind of thing. Boy, homeschool yeah. co-ops are just the best. I love them so much. And the teacher for it, I think her name was Sarah. I don't remember her last name. And she was so enthusiastic, just loved literature so much. And she's trying to teach me, a yeah. cynical, smart aleck of a 15-year-old. And she assigns The Great Gatsby.
Oh,
and she's just diving into the symbolism of The Great Gatsby and the beautiful prose and this and that. And I was like, this book is the worst. It's so dumb. It's so boring. It's about nothing. That was my attitude at 15 or 16.
Yeah.
Well, I read it again maybe 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah.
And she was 100% right.
It's brilliant.
It's one of my favorite novels. And I'm like, yeah, it might be the great American novel. It's pretty amazing.
Okay, so that, you did a full, I mean, you did 100% turn on that one.
Oh, yeah. And if I could if I could ever like reconnect with her in any way, I would immediately say, hey, you probably don't remember this, but you assigned us this book and I hated it. And then you were right. So thank you. So
what do you, okay, because I've read a little bit of Gatsby and I think I read it at a time like you when I just couldn't appreciate it. I didn't read the whole thing. Do you think
it's like 112 pages long. You can read the whole thing in an afternoon.
But I mean, is it the way it's written? Is it just going to be way beyond where like most like, you know, 11th graders are? Is it just content wise? You can't possibly be interested in it at that age.
Well, stylistically, it's written in a way it has sort of that 1920s mid-Atlantic sort of vibe to it, you know, rich Long Islanders kind of,
right.
And so there's a whole ethos and vibe about it that like an inner city Minneapolis 16-year-old is just going to be like, what in the blazes is going on here?
Yeah, for sure.
So yeah, so on my part, there was a lack of appreciation for just super clean prose with, you know, sharp description. And I just didn't have any insights into the human mind or condition or heart at 16. I was an idiot, as are most teenagers. And so I missed all the important stuff that the book was saying about how they made decisions and motivations and mistakes and regrets. And these just, you know, there's a lot in there that as an adult you read and you're like, ah, yes, this, he has his finger on the pulse of humanity in a remarkable way. And
well, and dude,
I
didn't even realize it was 112 pages. That you've almost, that almost inspires me to go back and read the thing, because I just, long books are like the death of me for some reason.
No,
like
it's closer to novella than it is novel. Like, it's not a long book, and it's
which is so funny. I know, which is so interesting.
And it's not a you know, there's some old novels that you get bogged down in because the prose is so dense. This is not one of those. It's a pretty light read, but the. In terms of like how it moves along, it's pretty crisp.
Yeah, for sure. I know it's one of those ones that, you know, it is considered one of the classics. You've either read it or you haven't. The one for me that I just can't, I've tried, I think I'm on my third attempt now, is I'm blanking out on it. That's how bad it is for me. It's that Dickens book, Tale of Two Cities. I just can't.
Oh, yes.
I've tried so many
Dickens,
times.
Dickens is tough to read. In that, like his books don't move. His writing is brilliant. His descriptions are amazing, and he clearly
was a
kind
of those describing things. I feel like that's all. Yeah. That's all he's doing the whole time, which is the most ignorant thing to say. I get it, because I do like some of other Dickens stuff, but like that one for me, I'm like literally like pipe. No exag, man. I get a little further every time, maybe like second, third chapter. And it's literally like, I might as well just start over, because I have no idea what he just said. I don't even know where we're at. I don't know what's going on. I don't know anything about the French Revolutionary War, and I feel like I know less about it now, chapter three in.
I feel like Charles Dickens, heavy on nouns, adjectives, short on verbs. Not a lot of movement.
I know. Like, okay, so here's my question then. So wouldn't we say, this is what's so funny about that, because I forget who I had a convo with this about the other day, like being like, So I knew this. There used to be this prof from our university that came to Substance, and then he moved away and got another job. But we used to talk a lot about books, and he said one, and he was a crazy reader. So he's like the dude that literally has read everything. And he said one of the things that he hates about modern authors is they lack that sort of like descriptive, you know, sort of like style of writing that you saw with people like Dickens or with like Tolkien and C.S. and all of that kind of stuff. And I said, yeah, I said, but what's so funny is that like when you take creative writing classes and you try to be a little more descriptive, it feels like all you do is get blasted for being too descriptive now. Like you can't have that many adjectives. You can't describe. I mean, it's like, well, yeah, but I mean, if you read Dickens, it's like that's all that guy's doing. And yet if you try to sort of have a semblance of that kind of writing now, it just gets super criticized, I guess.
Oh, yeah. And I think so. A lot of that is influenced by, you know, you get Stephen King's On Writing, and he, you know, he's like, kill your darlings. He hates adverbs.
He hates all that stuff. Right?
And exactly. And he just, you know, he wants verbs and things moving along. And so you leave the environment sparse so that people can fill it in with their imagination. So here's the thing, like, but description doesn't mean the book doesn't move, though, because like John Steinbeck maybe the greatest describer of any author I've read, by my preference at least. But his books go places and do things and stuff happens and you wonder what's going to happen next. And I feel like with Dickens, I'm mostly like, I don't care. I'm not compelled. That was a really good description. I can picture it really clearly. And now I'm also bored with what's happening.
Is it just because he was – well, yeah, no, for sure. Is it just because he was – I wonder if it's because he was English and he's speaking in a way that is so far removed – from how we even process or think through things now, that like it just doesn't land. Although when I read A Christmas Carol, it's like that, but it almost feels like it was written by a different guy than who wrote Tale of Two Cities, because it's so more easily it's so much more easily understood, and it really does move, you know, and it's not very long either, by the way, which maybe helps. But I just think that's fascinating, because if you even try to write a little more poetically now, it's almost like you get lambasted for not just like kind of sticking to it. And I wonder if that's more of just an American way of writing versus an English way of writing. I don't know.
I think it's American, but also just very modern. I mean, you look at the books that are considered classics versus the books that sell best today. You can't even call most best-selling novels today literature. You can call them stories, but they're not literature. They're not. I'm trying to remember it's a super short list of authors today who I go, that's a brilliant writer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, there's Leif Anger's on that list. Pat Conroy's passed away now, but he was on that list up until a few years ago. Frederick Backman is on that list. There's not a ton of others. Sure. So you're like, these people write literature.
But you know what's funny, Pipe, about that list is like, I'm even thinking of Backman and Engers, and like, they're so completely different. And like, I could, if somebody, and I love Engers, you know, but if somebody came to me and said, his writing drives me up the wall, I wish he would get to the point, I would just go, fair. Like, I can't argue with that. I just enjoy it because of the way he describes things. But if somebody was going to make the case, like, oh my gosh, it's like, what does the dude spend like 4 days on one sentence? It drives me up the wall. I would go, okay. Like, I don't know what to tell you other than that's fair.
Yeah. And right? I have had people tell me that. They're like, his books are not about anything. And I'm like, that's not true, but I can absolutely see why you think that.
Yeah. So it's, yeah, it's, that's interesting, isn't it? That's interesting. But back to the original point of, actually, we don't really have an original point now. We've been talking about Christian school.
Yeah. So it was books that you hated and then came to like later. Let's reverse it. And this is probably going to be a better one for you because you didn't read anything. Books you didn't read that like most people get assigned in school that you discovered as an adult and thought, oh, this is pretty great.
Well, this is going to be right in line with all of our, you know, Christian literature stuff. But I remember when I first got married, and I remember Big M, when she found out that I hadn't read The Hobbit. I mean, I literally thought like our marriage is in trouble right now.
Like she went to the local priest and said, "How do I get an annulment?"
Literally. I mean, it was like she was so offended by that. She goes, what are they teaching kids in those schools anyway? Little Lewis for you. But she was so offended by that. And she said, for the life of me, she goes, I cannot fathom that you didn't read The Hobbit. You haven't read Lord of the Rings. And so she immediately started me with not The Hobbit actually, but with Lord of the Rings. And so I read through all of that, and I was, you know, it's weird. I read it way before the movies came out. And I read them all straight through, and I loved parts of them, hated parts of them, thought it was brilliant, didn't think it was as brilliant as all the hippies thought it was back in 1967. But I definitely was captivated by it to where when I found out they were making movies, I was really excited about that. But that would have been one that just totally escaped me. And I felt a lot of shame about it. But then when I read it, I was like, no, this is something else. This is something different. This is something brilliant. This is not something you're going to see written again, probably, you know, in my lifetime.
Yeah. And the closest things to it since then have been either more childish, like Harry Potter.
Right.
Or just like really dark and amoral, like the Game of Thrones series. So similar in terms of like world building and scope and whatever, but just kind of heinous in their own right.
On that though, Pipe, you know, let me just add this. So I remember when I was touring a lot when Potter came out, and my wife had read, you know, the first book in like 20 minutes, and everybody was talking about it. And normally I just kind of back off. I kind of wait till the hype dies down for stuff like that. But Big M kind of got me on that really quick. And I remember reading the first, I think it was after the second one came out. So I had a couple of them I could read. I was in an airport. And I remember just thinking like, man, I love these books. Like they're just, I love how fast paced they are. I love like the details she goes into, but she doesn't drown in the detail. And then there's like the story, you know, she really, really like moves into like character development. And I remember just thinking, dude, I'm a huge Potter fan. I love these books.
Oh yeah. Those would probably fit the bill for me. Ones that I skipped when I was younger. I don't know when the first one came out. I want to say like late '90s, 97, 98.
Early 2000s.
Maybe early 2000s. Okay. So I was past the point of being sort of age appropriate for those. And then I didn't read any of them until the first six were out. So whatever. So I was probably mid-20s. And then I finished the sixth one kind of just in time for the last one to come out. And so I read that. And just, yeah, I mowed through those. It was like a book a week, you know, for 6 weeks. And then the seventh one came out. And yeah. And to this day, they're on sort of that pinnacle of greatest stories. I think the one for me, so I think a lot of people get To Kill a Mockingbird assigned to them in school.
Oh yeah.
Which is a travesty, because that's not a book that it's a book that's lost on high school sophomores is what it is. And so I didn't ever read it because it was never assigned to me, probably because I skipped schools a bunch. And as a sophomore, I was homeschooled and my mom, you know, had me read other things. But I read it when I was like 30.
Oh man.
And it climbed right to the top of greatest novels, you know. So if The Great Gatsby sort of like literary quality greatest American novel, this one was just sort of like the greatest, like grab you by the gut kind of novel. And yeah, just had no idea what I had missed. Although I also thought about it and thought if I had read this at 16, I wouldn't have read it at 30, and I would have thought it was boring. So I'm glad I didn't.
Yes. So yeah, that's a big one. I actually haven't read To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, really? I would love to hear your thoughts on it. It's another one that reads quick. It's not super short, but it's not like a fat novel. Yeah, you should definitely read that one sometime in the next couple months.
I mean, I think the last classic that I read, I think right before COVID, was Jane Eyre. I hadn't read Jane Eyre, and I finally read it, and it was just absolutely brilliant. So it's like all the stuff that people have always said about it that's great is true, you know, kind of a thing.
I haven't read that one. The British romance stuff is not on my – was not in my purview for a long time, and so it just – yeah, other books have climbed the list before it, but it's on sort of the books I feel guilty about not having read list.
Well, and I wouldn't, and I know it, there is like a romance aspect of it, but it really is more of, and I know what you're saying, but it's really more of like, it's one of those things where it's a, like the writing is astounding. Like you're reading it going, I don't know how somebody writes like this. It's like so amazing. You when know, it's, you describe, it's just, it's, you know, you can't even conceive of how somebody was able to do that.
Well, and I would say, there was a long time where books, like I was just sort of a sexist young man. So like teenager and early 20s, I was like, I don't want to read a romance story written by a woman. That sounds terrible. That is no longer the case, but my reading habits have changed to the point where I just haven't sort of worked that back in. And I feel like there's sort of like a significant literary hole in my life for not having read books like
Jane. Well, yeah, of course. It's just not, it's like, it's not something you're initially drawn to. And I think, in the same way that like other things I wouldn't be initially drawn to, like Melissa likes a lot of Stephen King, and she likes like those she likes a lot of mystery. Well, he's just a great writer, but she likes everything he does, and she likes his real sort of like creepy mystery stuff. I'm just not drawn to that. I wouldn't say it's not good. I'm just not drawn to it. So it's not going to be a go-to for me. But I realize at the same time that if I ever just dove in and gave myself over to it, I'd probably totally dig it. You know what I mean?
See, I've read some Stephen King, and he's one of those guys who the creepier his stories are, the less I like them. But when he writes just sort of when his imagination comes out to play, because I feel like his creepy stories are not as imaginative. It's just dark and ghoulish. But like, what was it? 11/22/64, 63?
Sure.
The one, it's a book about a guy who finds a portal to go back in time, and his mission is essentially to stop JFK from being killed.
Oh,
but then
right.
he has to.
Yeah.
But he goes back a year prior to JFK's assassination. And so he has to live a year in that time period to get there. And so it's just super imaginative in terms of the relationships and the effects on the future if you succeed and so forth. And I think it would be like King at his best, because it's not just sort of dark horror kind of stuff, or
right.
supernatural. It's pretty brilliant.
Well, that's what I mean. So if you talk to Big M, she's always going to say like he actually doesn't write that much dark, creepy stuff. He usually writes more of like what you're describing, just more like interesting stories. You know, he's known for dark, creepy stuff, but she always say the majority of his books aren't that. And so that's why she's always pitching me it like,
yeah,
that.
See,
like, it's not like that. You know,
he wrote The Green Mile, right?
Right. Yeah.
So The Green Mile is another one that it's not horror. And it is brilliant. It's the characters are great. It has a supernatural element because he loves the supernatural. Like he's enamored with
that. Yeah,
he's enamored with it in kind of a dabbling around the edges way, though.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, and then he does like the what is it, the Gunslinger ones or whatever it is, Dark Tower, all that, whatever those are. It's like 72 books in that series. I've tried to start those half a dozen times. I make it about six paragraphs in and go, I don't know. I don't care what's happening.
That's so funny because like, don't you wish you would love it? Because it's like, if you loved it, there's so much of it. You know what I mean? It's almost like when somebody tells you, hey, I'm picking up Harry Potter for the first time. And you're like jealous because like you wish you could do it again for the first time.
Oh, absolutely. Or, you know, starting on a TV series that you watch the entirety of, you know, it was 8 seasons. You're like, oh, this is great. You get to watch 8 seasons of brilliance.
I know. You're like jealous. It's crazy.
Yeah, I feel a little bit like that, but those – I'm just never going to love those from King.
I know. It's weird. It's weird, man.
All right. Last question. This is going to be the one – yeah, we'll just end with this one. What is a book that is widely loved that you cannot stand?
Oh, man.
Or you could just answer, what is a book that you cannot stand?
Yeah, gosh, I know I already talked about Tale of Two Cities, but I haven't even given that a fair shake. I think the one in Crystal, okay, here's something, I'll just make this a little more funny. I think the cringiest one in Christian circles that like every woman and unhappy man has ever read is this horrible book called Redeeming Love. And it's just like, I don't know, this tale of this woman that gets all this redemption. And I think they're making a movie out of it right now. But that is something that even me, Big R, with all of his Christmas and love of those kinds of like romantic tales, like I can't get myself to stomach, because I like a little, I'm okay with a little cheese on occasion, but I do have my standards. And that is one that has just been sort of thrust, you know, on us, you know, on the Christian community as something that, you know, it became like just this unheralded classic. And you're probably like, I've never even heard of it. You know,
I have heard of it. I don't know anything about it. It's funny to me how books are defined by eras.
Yes, for sure.
You know, so like there were phenomenon books of eras that have, well, 10 years later, just don't exist in consciousness anymore.
I think to get cheesy, since I'm on a Christian school, cheesy Christian culture kind of mindset right now, I think at one point I read This Present Darkness and I was like, this is so dumb. Like, I don't even know what.
I read. So here's the thing. There's the proper audience for This Present Darkness and Piercing the Darkness, which for listeners who don't know, are spiritual warfare novels by Frank Peretti that came out, I want to say early 80s. I read those when I was like 8.
And you probably loved them, right?
Because oh, it was
so creepy.
8 to 12 years old is the perfect audience for appreciating that, as long as the parents are very clear to say, this is not how spiritual warfare actually works, as far as we know. This is allegorical at best, probably just imaginative nonsense.
But I mean, Pipe, let me ask you this. He was for sure the recommended, if you like, Stephen King guy for the Christian world, right?
Yeah, prior to Ted Decker.
Yeah, prior to Decker, right, exactly. And by the way, I thought for years, I thought Decker was Peretti. I thought they were the same person.
So. Just like different pen names, or you just got
literally
confused?
Like I didn't like if somebody would have said, hey, have you read This Present Darkness by Ted Decker? I would have said, oh yeah, I hated it. You know, I wouldn't have even like blinked.
Yeah. All right. So books that are widely loved that I can't stand. I almost want to take this in categories, but that's cheating. So for example, like parenting books, Christian parenting books. I have never read a parenting book that I liked.
Oh, okay. So yeah, I was thinking fiction, man. So yeah, keep talking. I'll be able to come up with something.
Yeah, I mean, we can do a list of these. Even the ones like Shepherding a Child's Heart, and some of those that are people are like, but it's a different kind of parenting book. It is a different kind of parenting book that I still can't stand. I don't know if it's some of it's probably arrogance. I don't like being told what to do. And every parenting book, no matter how hard it tries not to, does if you parent like this, your kids will turn out well. Like that
For
is
sure.
the innate promise. And I think it's nonsense. I think every parenting book that I've read makes parents feel guiltier, or maybe it just makes me feel guiltier for not living up to the standards they hold. And I think there's a lot of extra biblical nonsense in them, drawing on, like the Bible says, relatively little about parenting.
Mm-hmm.
It just does.
Yeah.
You know, it says like don't exasperate your children, spare the rod, spoil the child is in there, raise up a child in the way he should go. A lot of these parenting books treat proverbs like promises, which is also nonsense. So yeah, parenting books as a whole, I really struggle with and think
weird.
Are terrible. I'm trying to think of one that's just widely loved. That
I probably should have read
into.
A parenting book during my parenting years. But so that's
see, no, but
story.
Here's the thing. If you had and things didn't go well, it would have just added more guilt for you. Because
we all have enough guilt.
Every parent is either arrogant or guilty. those are where we land. So
and if their kids are just like killing it, they're arrogant. Yeah. And if their kids are just in there, whatever their version of not crushing it is, they're crushed for sure.
I would also venture to say that I have achieved a level of hatred for Enneagram books at this point.
Dude, have you read Road Back to You?
Yes.
Okay.
I think this is probably a discussion for a different day, but more and more, I'm coming to resent the Enneagram as opposed to finding it valuable anymore.
Does your church like it or hate it?
People at my church love it. The church leadership is silent on it because it's just like it's not part of how we think or what we do in terms of the church as a whole. I find that it has moved from, so there's things that I think it has value if it's used appropriately. The problem is it's never used appropriately. It is used so that I can think about me, which we don't need any more help doing, or it is used so that I can label you, which we don't need any more help doing. And I think the reason this dawned on me is because once it became very clear that I'm an Enneagram 8, I have been labeled an 8 by people in a sort of writing me off way. And so it's just like, oh, you're an 8. Like,
yeah,
it's no, used I'm a flippant. Human.
Yeah, it's used very flippantly.
And so the thing is, it's very easy for me to do that in return. Oh, you're such a whatever, such a 1, such a 3, such a whatever. I think the Enneagram is harmful more than it is helpful at this point. And so the more books that are written about it, which honestly, there's going to be a flood more because it's still very popular and people can make money off of it. I think they are crystallizing things that are much that are really unhelpful by and large.
That could be true, Pipe. I'm not even going to disagree with that. I am just going to issue a warning that the same people that might start saying Enneagram is harmful are the same people that might start saying we should defy the government and meet in our churches of like 5,000 people. I'm just saying.
No, and that's the thing is like I recognize that I might accidentally be siding with somebody who I wish would stop saying a lot of other things. And I don't mean it that way. This is very context specific to
joking. Yes.
But you're not wrong though, because the Enneagram has been written off from the get-go by a certain swath of evangelicalism who, you know, they're like Enneagram, more like pentagram. Am I right? And, there's no nuance in that thought, and they don't understand what they're criticizing.
But I think what you said is right, though, Pipe. I mean, I think you can use it to write off people. You can also use it as an excuse to justify your behavior. You can do that with any one of those personality tests, even though Enneagram's not a personality test. I know.
The danger of the Enneagram is that it has been Christianized.
Yeah.
Where it's
gospelized, yes.
Yeah, and so there's a – like, it is not an innately Christian thing. Unless it is attached to something that has like a biblical moral gravity to it, it's just another labeling system that sort of psychologizes people, which can be very useful. For sure. So the people have it just sounds like it has become another round of pop psychology with a Christian spin, you know. And
I think you're right. I think it
and
is.
I think that's harmful.
Oh, go ahead. I think what you're saying, I think what I'm curious about it with, and I talk about it more in jest than I do any sort of taking it seriously like some people do. But for me, I wonder if it's going to be something that has a shelf life to it. And, you know, 5 years from now, we're not really going to be making a big deal about it, or if it's going to be almost like deconstructed in such a way that it's not really even the Enneagram anymore.
I think it's going to follow in the footsteps of the five love languages where people know their love language and don't know that that came from a book written by a Christian guy, you know, so five that love languages happen. Written by Gary Chapman in the early 90s became like, it is a category of thought that people have that they have no idea is attached to a book. And I kind of think the Enneagram is going to achieve that, but it's more complicated, so it'll be on a smaller scale. There's 9 of them with subtypes and wings and stuff. So
what I was saying. Yeah, that's what I meant by sort of like deconstruction. I mean, they're going to have to make it more simple because it does get into the weeds, and so they got to come up with like a 3-page version of it to where you can kind of look at it, kind of know who you are, and kind of get to all some of the outerlying, you know, kind of things that feed into it very simply and quickly. I think it's it's still too complex, because for you to have to buy a book like Road Back to You to even sort of get like a cursory like understanding of it, it just means that it's way too far over the heads of most people. They need to distill it down. And then I think that's actually brilliant. I think it could be like a five love languages thing for sure. It's going to take somebody brilliant to grab it and say, we got to pop this. We got to make this thing more commercial. We got to make it more pop. And if they can do that, yeah, man, they'll really have something.
Yeah. I think part of the reason that that won't happen is because the people who love it love the fact that they get to like swim in the deep waters of self. So I got types and subtypes and wings and subwings, and what do I go to in health and what do I go to in unhealth? And it just, all of this is just, it's just orbiting myself. I'm getting to know me so well at the expense of me and everyone around me. And I don't think people are going to give that up. And so to simplify it is to lose like what makes it addictive.
Yeah, no, for sure. I can't disagree with that, man. Yeah.
So one last thing on the Enneagram. I had a conversation. My wife Lauren went to an Enneagram seminar a couple weekends ago, and
nice.
And so, which again, I don't scoff at, and I don't think there's anything wrong with it. But the funny part of the conversation was, she's like, "Oh, it's being put on by somebody who, she's offering this at a really." I think she offered it for free. And I was like, "Really? Usually those cost a lot." And she goes, "Yeah." She was going to become a certified Enneagram coach, but it cost so much. And then she was like, how is, you know, the person who was going to do it was like, how do we, you know, how do you make this worth it? And they're like, well, you charge a lot for your seminars at that point.
Yeah.
By being a certified Enneagram coach. And so she decided not to be certified. And so she's just doing this kind of for people in her circle for free. And I was like, this whole thing is nonsense. It is an idea that somebody cobbled together and then attached a dollar amount to a certification that they get to hold over other people. Like I mean, I realize this is the way that all of America works. Like, I'm a certified leadership guru or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about like guys that preach sermons now too, right? So,
well, but at least they have like a salaried position at a church. This is more like the leadership consultant is what it's kind of, it's just that, but I'm like, it's, this woman could have charged whatever she wanted and called herself a certified Enneagram coach, and it would have been just as legitimate as if she had received the certification for $8,000 or whatever from this other made up certified coach.
Right.
It is the strangest thing that it's now there's a level of sort of concreteness to this that we can attach dollar amounts to certification or not certification.
Yeah.
About something that anybody can make up anything about, because it's a cobbled together set of ideas.
Except somebody would really, like a super Enneagram guy would argue with those last two sentences. They would take uppance to those.
Sure, they would. That's fine. Like it.
They would say it's not cobbled together. If it's cobbled together, then you're somebody that just hasn't, you know, gotten your game down on it or whatever.
Yeah, well, I think right, and then we pay them a lot of money because they're the certified ones.
Is Lauren diagnosing you all the time now that she's had her any seminar?
No, she. What's funny is she went and she was like, "I was like,
you're
know,
such an A-type."
Well,
you just said that because you're such.
She
an
said
A.
to me, she goes, "I actually paid a lot more attention to your number than mine when she was talking through them because I wanted hilarious. To kind of figure this out." And I'm like, "I don't know if that's good or bad, but so far it's been fine. There's no like flinging it at me. The dismissive eight thing comes from other people, not the person I'm married to, which is great. but yeah, I think the Enneagram has become an excuse to stereotype people and to be a navel gazer. By well, and large, I think that's how people use it. I don't think that
I totally agree.
So yeah, that's I scoff at Enneagram books.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. It is very navel-gazy. It kind of keeps you trapped in sort of this perpetual self-focus, and it allows you to easily categorize people, which we like to do because that feels safer to us. So I would agree with you on that.
And to end on a very churchy, Christian-y note, the Enneagram seems to be opposed to sanctification, the way that it is used by people, because it is so much about who you are, not who you should be, like, be growing into.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I have not heard anybody write or say anything useful about the Enneagram as it pertains to growing in holiness. One of those things matters. The other one is a made up set of nine numbers. So,
okay. So, yeah, that's
that,
true.
That missing aspect of it. Like if somebody could write a brilliant book about the Enneagram and growing to be more like Jesus, I may make an exception for that, but I have see it.
There are people in, so there are people associated with my network and beyond that have all done exactly what you're saying. They're more quote unquote certified Enne people. They use it as a sanctification tool. They just not written books about it because they don't have like a platform to write books, but they've done all the work and the study and they go and they'll lead churches and staffs through it as what you're describing. Like, hey, this is not just, this is who I am and there's no moving past it. And I just get to criticize everybody else in navel gaze for the rest of my life. But they use it as a way to say, you're just gaining better self-knowledge as a way to, you know, become more sanctified in the different areas God's growing you in. So that actually does exist, right? Nobody's written a book,
I understand
though.
The thoughts exist. I mean, if I think about the Enneagram, I'm trying to think about it in that way. But yeah. Everything that is being sold and purchased surrounding this thing seems to be more pop psychology than grow in holiness.
Well, if we can grow in holiness with it, at some point we won't need it anymore. And then therefore it's not really selling, you know, like it needs to. So there is that aspect.
Man, I wish we could grow out of all Christian living books. That'd be amazing.
Well, then we wouldn't have anything to write about.
Fine. If readers didn't need what I thought I was offering them, it'd be amazing.
So Pipe, I think we've all grown out of it. So we should just like maybe cut the release of your new book. Everything will be great now. Everything's cool.
No, I think my book is the icing on the cake.
Is that it? Is that the
Hoping final? For Happiness, releasing October 1st, is the final Christian book you need to read. I think that's what we just landed on.
No more. Okay, after that, man, none of us are writing any more Christian living books.
None.
Ever.
Not a single one.
Hoping for Happiness, that is the peak. That's the pinnacle.
Yeah.
I'm happy with that. I mean,
good.
I have a couple I'd like to write, but you know what? If you've written the pinnacle, why
the book,
would I
the book
even
worked
attempt?
And you haven't even read it yet.
I believe you because, you know, we're co-hosts. I have to believe you. So
that's not how that works.
We got to end this. It's an hour and 7 minutes.
That's all right. This is what happens when Ted's gone. This is why at Jared C., who's no longer listening because he doesn't like us, thinks it's terrible with Ted gone.
He's going to hate this app. And so good. Since you opened, let me close and just say we've done what we always do. We've wandered to and fro. And until next time.
The Happy Rant is brought to you by Resonate Recordings. If you go to resonaterecordings.com, you can see the full range of services they offer. So if you're considering starting a podcast, they are the ones we recommend going with. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see their prices, to connect with them and ask any questions, and to see what they can do to help you launch, edit, master, and improve your podcast. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see what they can do to help you launch and improve your podcast.
I'm Don Hawkins, and I once heard Chick-fil-A founder Truett Cathy say, "You can tell if a person needs encouragement, check to see if they're breathing." I'd like to invite you to my weekly podcast, Encouragement for You, featuring encouraging guests like Dr. Greg and Aaron Smalley, Dan Cathy, the late Dr. Frank Menrith, Josh McDowell, and more. To subscribe to my weekly Encouragement for You podcast, go to lifeaudio.com. That's lifeaudio.com.